Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight I'm going to read from a book that's called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. And it's a fascinating book, actually. I hope I had my notes, but I guess I don't. Notes somewhere else. I had a whole series of notes on this book, and I misplaced them. Very upsetting. When you do stuff like that. But anyway, that's par for the course. That's what I do, folks. I have a tendency to misplace things. But what I wanted to talk about tonight was in this book was that. They were rather profound statements that it may have been made here. And the book is, Eric Fromm was a great, really great psychologist. I don't know, I should know, but I believe he's passed away. I don't know if he is or not. I should have looked that up. This book was dated 1996, I believe, it came out. Oh no, I'm sorry, 1973. And I'm not sure if Mr. Fromm is, I shouldn't say, he's still alive or not. He was at the time of this writing. I mean, for a number of years after this book. But in fact, if you just hold on, hey, you know, it's funny, I never thought about it. I think he's passed away, but. Just gonna check. That was strange. That he died in 1980 at the age of 79, and. Eric Fromm was born on the 23rd of March, 1900, in Frankfurt. Orthodox Jewish parents. During the mid-20s, he was trained to become a psychoanalyst. And then he, after the Nazi takeover of power in Germany, Fromm moved to Geneva, and then in 1934 to Columbia University, and Karen Horney, long-term infatuation with Fromm and the subject of her book Self-Analysis, believe that each has a lasting influence on each other's thoughts. Aside from that, just to note that the man has passed away, and he noted for some profound thought in psychology. I don't know. I really never read much of Fromm, not that I. You know, based mostly on my own. What can I say? My own. Not so much indifference, but I just wasn't at that level. For most years, most of his work never really caught me until I found this book, Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, and I started to understand the basic. As I read it, I started to understand some of the basic concepts behind the. Psychosis, if you will, of society, of modern society, as well as primitive society, which he talks about in here, and primarily what creates the destructiveness, the destructive patterns in mankind. It's a fascinating topic because we all struggle with it, and from attempted to suggest that it's essentially part of human nature, because it doesn't, it's not anything that, it's not something that's normal in nature. The destructive patterns of mankind, how mankind can be sadistic and masochistic and indifferent and so on and so forth. And is it a part of their culture, or is it a part of their physical genetics, part of being man? Is it a biological rather than a metaphysical concept? Where primarily what he states in here is that man is that some of it, or a lot of it, has to do with man's higher self, right, and lower self. Man has the unique ability to gain pleasure out of inflicting pain on others, tricking others, people. Man gets joy, or I shouldn't say joy is not a good word, but pleasure, a sensual pleasure, and out of tricking is, or out of outsmarting is opponents, or his enemies, or his, you know, or his friends. You know, man can be extremely selfish and extremely arrogant and extremely brutal and ruthless. And we find that, and we're not really sure why. Well, Mr. Frome discovered part of that. I'm going to jump around tonight, because the book is 500 pages, and it covers a great deal of information that, you know, a lot of background to this. But one of the best places to start is that I've seen so far is the primitive hunters and the affluent society. Let me go even on, yeah. Here's something. They talk about different tribes. This one in particular is an Eskimo tribe. Among other hunting societies, private quarrels are not solved as charmingly as by the Eskimos, but by a spear-throwing duel. When a dispute is between an accuser and a defendant, which is commonly the case, the accuser ritually hurls the spear from a prescribed distance, while the defendant dodges them. The public can applaud the speed, force the accuracy of the accuser as he hurls his spear or spears, or then can applaud the adroitness with which the defendant dodges them. After a time, unanimity is achieved as the approval for one or the other skill gradually becomes overwhelming. When the defendant realizes that the community is finally considering him guilty, he is supposed to fail to dodge a spear and allow himself to be wounded in some fleshy part of the body. Conversely, the accuser simply stops throwing the spears when he becomes aware that the public opinion is going against him. Now, that's kind of interesting. That's one way that they settle their disputes as Eskimos. And it'd be kind of cool if people did that too. But in some way they do, not quite as primitively, but when you get enough people howling at you, they finally give in. You know, it's like the Republicans or the Democrats or whatever, anybody's, if there's enough howling against you, you eventually, you know, give in to their request or give in to being wrong or whatever the situation may be. But it's interesting how different societies handle these issues of disputes or anger or, you know, these type of things, the destructive aspects of our patterns in one society. And here in the primitive hunters, the affluent society. A very relevant point, and one even interesting for the analysis of the contemporary industrial society, is made by M.D. Salines with regard to the whole question of economic scarcity among private hunters and the modern attitude toward the problem of what constitutes poverty. He argues against the premise that led to the idea of the aggressiveness of the primitive hunter, namely that life in the Paleolithic period was one of extreme scarcity and constant confrontation with starvation. In contrast, Salines emphasizes that the society of primitive hunters was the original affluent society. By common understanding, an affluent society is one in which all the people's wants are easily satisfied. And though we are pleased to consider this happy condition the unique achievement of industrial civilization, a better case can be made for hunters and gatherers, even many of the marginal ones spared to ethnography. For wants are easily satisfied, either by producing much or desiring little, and there are, accordingly, two possible roads to affluence. Adopting a Zen strategy, a people can enjoy an unparalleled material plenty, although perhaps on a low standard of living, that I think describes the hunters. Salines makes some further very pertinent statements. Scarcity is the peculiar obsession of a business economy, the calculable condition of all who participate in it. The market makes freely available a dazzling array of products. All these goods are within a man's reach, but never his grasp, for one never has enough to buy everything. And to exist in the market economy is to live out a double tragedy, beginning in inadequacy and ending in deprivation. We stand sentenced to life at hard labor. It is for this anxious vantage that we look back on the hunter. But if modern man, with all his technical advantages, still hasn't got the wherewithal, what chance has this naked savage with his puny bow and arrow? Having equipped the hunter with bourgeois impulses and Paleolithic tools, we judge his situation hopeless in advance. Scarcity is not an intrinsic property of technical means. It is a relation between means and ends. We might entertain the empirical possibility that hunters are in business for their health, a finite objective, and bow and arrow are adequate to that end. A fair case can be made that hunters often work much less than we do, and rather than a grind, the food quest is intermittent. Leisure is abundant, and there is more sleep in the daytime per capita than in any other conditions of society. Rather than anxiety, it would seem the hunter has a confidence born of affluence, of a condition in which all the people's wants, such as they are generally easily satisfied. And this confidence does not desert them during hardship. This attitude has been expressed by the philosophy of Pinan of Borneo. If there is no food today, will there be tomorrow, is the name of his article. Primitive warfare. Although defensive aggression, destructiveness, and cruelty are not ordinarily the cause of war, these impulses manifest themselves in warfare. Hence, some data on primitive warfare will help to complete the picture of primitive aggression. Miggett gives a summation of the nature of warfare among the Wildbury of Australia, which service states may be accepted as an apt characteristic or characterization of warfare in hunting-gathering societies generally. Waldbeere society did not emphasize militarism. There was no class of permanent or professional warriors. There was no hierarchy of military command, and groups rarely engaged in wars of conquest. Every man was and is still a potential warrior, always armed and ready to defend his rights. But he was also an individualist who preferred to fight independently. In some disputes, kinship ties allied men into opposed camps, and such a group may occasionally have comprised all the men of a community. But there are no military leaders, elected or hereditary, to plan tactics and ensure the other has adopted the plan. Although some men were respected as capable and courageous fighters, and their advice was valued, other men did not necessarily follow them. Moreover, the range of circumstances in which fights occurred was, in effect, so limited that men knew and could employ the most effective techniques without hesitation. This is still true today, even of young bachelors. And this is in the Waldbeere Society, Primitive Society. There was, in any case, little reason for all-out warfare between communities. Slavery was unknown, portable goods were few, and the territory seized in a battle were virtually an embarrassment to the victors, whose spiritual ties were with other localities. Small-scale wars of conquest differed only in degree from intra-tribal and even intra-community fights. Thus, the attack on the Wurundjeri that led to the occupation of the waterholes in the Tanami area involved only Waniga men, a few score at most, and I have no evidence that communities ever entered into military alliances either to oppose other Waldbeere communities or other tribes. And technically speaking, this kind of conflict among primitive hunters can be described as war in the sense one may conclude that war has always existed within the human species. And hence, that it is the manifestation of an innate drive to kill. This reasoning, however, ignores the profound differences in the warfare of lower and higher primitive cultures, as well as the warfare of civilized cultures. Primitive warfare, particularly that of the lower primitives, was neither centrally organized nor led to the permanent chieftains. It was relatively infrequent. It was not war or of conquest, nor was it bloody war aimed at killing as many of the enemy as possible. Most civilized war, in contrast, is institutionalized, organized by permanent chieftains, and aims at conquest of territory and or acquisition of slaves and or booty. In addition, perhaps most important of all is the frequently overlooked fact that there is no important economic stimulus among primitive hunter-gatherers to full-scale war. The birth-death ratio in hunting-gathering societies is such that it would be rare for population pressure to cause some part of the population to fight others for territorial acquisition. Even if such a circumstance occurred, it would not lead to much of a battle. The stronger, more numerous group would simply prevail, probably even without a battle. If the hunting rights or rights of some gathered spot were demanded. In the second place, there is not much to gain by plunder in hunting-gathering societies. All bands are poor in material goods, and there are no standard items of exchange that serve the capital or as valuables. Finally, at the hunting-gathering level, the acquisition of captives to serve as slaves for economic exploitation, a common cause of warfare in more modern times, would be useless, given the low productivity of the economy. And captives and slaves would have a different time producing more than enough food to sustain themselves. The overall picture of warfare among primitive hunter-gatherers given by service is supported and supplemented by a number of other investigators, some of whom are quoted in the following paragraphs. So, and there are more. There are more examples of this, you know, and how the hunter-gatherer concept still remains. But as we get into an evolving society, where we become farmers and so on and so forth, the land becomes more essential as far as you know, property. Then the world changes and we become more territorial and more protective of our properties and more aggressive toward other people and sharing, you know, the land, whereas the Indians and so on, I mean, the land was everyone's, you know, there was no... They shared with the white man until they found out the white man wanted everything. So... they had to go to war. Anyway, but they lost. And the indigenous people are still losing everywhere around the world. But let me get into the Neolithic Revolution. A detailed description of the life of primitive hunters and food gatherers has shown that man, at least since he fully emerged 50,000 years ago, was most likely not the brutal, destructive, cruel being, and hence not the prototype of man the killer that we find in more developed stages of his evolution. However, we cannot stop here. In order to understand the gradual development of man the exploiter and the destroyer, it is necessary to deal with the development of man during the period of early agriculture, and eventually with his transformation into a builder of cities, a warrior, and a trader. From the emergence of man, approximately 500,000 years ago to about 9,000 BC, man did not change in one respect. He lived from what he gathered or hunted, but did not produce anything new. He was completely dependent on nature and did not himself influence or transform it. This relationship to nature changed radically with the invention of agriculture and animal husbandry, and occurred roughly with the beginning of the Neolithic period, more precisely the proto-neolithic. Thank you, proto-neolithic. That was a tough one. A proto-neolithic period, as archaeologists call it today, from 9,000 to 7,000 BC, and in any area stretching over 1,000 miles from western Iran to Greece, including parts of Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and Anatolian plateau in Turkey. It started later in the central and northern Europe. For the first time, man made himself within certain limits, independent of nature, by using his inventiveness and skill to produce something beyond that which nature had thus far yielded to him. It was now possible to plant more seed, to till more land, and to breed more animals as the population increased. And surplus food could be slowly accumulated to support craftsmen who devoted most of their time to the manufacture of tools, pottery, and clothing. The first great discovery made in this period was the cultivation of wheat and barley, which has been growing wild in this area. It was discovered that by putting seed of these grasses into the earth, new plants would grow, that one could select the best seeds for sowing, and eventually the accidental crossing of varieties was observed, which produced grains very much larger than the seeds of the wild grasses. And the process of development from wild grasses to high-yielding modern wheat is not yet fully known. It involved gene mutations, hybridization, and chromosome doubling, and it has taken thousands of years to achieve the artificial selection by man on the level of present-day agriculture. For man in the industrial age, accustomed to looking down on non-industrial agriculture as a primitive rather obvious form of production, the Neolithic discoveries may not seem comparable to the great technical discoveries of our day, of which we are so proud. Yet the fact that the expectation that seed could grow was proved correct by results gave rise to an entirely new concept. Man recognized that he could use his will and intention to make this happen, instead of things just happening. It would be exaggerated to say that the discovery of agriculture was the foundation of all scientific thinking and later technical development. The second discovery was that of animal breeding, which was made in the same period. Sheep were already domesticated in the 9th millennium in northern Iraq, and cattle and pigs around 6000 BC. Sheep and cattle raising resulted in additional food supply, milk, and greater abundance of meat. The increased and more stable food supply permitted a sedentary instead of a nomadic form of life and led to the construction of permanent villages and towns. In the Proto-Neolithic period, tribes of hunters invented and developed a new settled economy based on the domestication of plants and animals. Although the earliest remains of domesticated plants do not yet much antedate 7000 BC, the standard of a domestication reached and the variety of crops grown presupposes a long history of earlier climate. It gets a little technical here, but it gets into archaeology and so on here, and I think I'll pass on that because I really wanted to touch more on the crazy behavior, you know. This chapter, Malignant Aggression and Cruelty and Destructiveness. And this is more interesting because he talks about the different some of the disorders that we face and some of that have been in for instance, you have varieties of aggression are quite different. Malignant aggression premises. Yeah. Well, malignant aggression essentially, we're given a description of it. Spontaneous forms. Destructiveness appears in two forms: spontaneous and bound in the character structure. By the former, I refer to the outburst of dormant, not necessarily repressed, destructive impulses that are activated by extraordinary circumstances. In contrast to the permanent, although not always expressed, presence of destructive traits in the character. Is a historical record. The most ample and horrifying documentation for seemingly spontaneous forms of destructiveness are on the record of civilized history. The history of war is a report of ruthless and indiscriminate killing and torture, whose victims were men, women, and children. Many of these occurrences give the impression of orgies of destruction, in which neither conventional nor genuinely moral factors had any inhibitory effect. Killing was still the mildest manifestation of destructiveness. But the orgies did not stop here. Men were castrated, women were disemboweled, prisoners were crucified or thrown before the lions. There is hardly a destructive act human imagination could not think of that was not has not been acted out again and again. We have witnessed the same frenzied mutual killing of hundreds of thousands of Hindus and Muslims in India during the partition, and in Indonesia in the anti-communist purge in 1965. There were, according to varying sources, from 400,000 to 1 million real or alleged communists, together with many Chinese, were slaughtered. I need not go further in giving a more detailed description of the manifestation of human destructiveness. They are well known, and besides, often quoted by those who want to prove that destructiveness is innate. And for instance, Dr. Freeman, 1964. As to the causes of destructiveness, we will be dealt with when we shall discuss sadism and necrophilia. I mention these outbursts here in order to give example for destructiveness that is not bound in the character structure, as is the case with the sadistic and necrophilous character. But these destructive explosions are not spontaneous in the sense that they break out without any reason. In the first place, there are always external conditions that stimulate them, such as wars, religions, political conflicts, poverty, extreme boredom, and insignificance of the individual. Secondly, there are subjective reasons. Extreme groups, group narcissism, in national or religious terms, as in India, a certain proneness to a state of trance, as in parts of Indonesia. It is not human nature that makes a sudden appearance, but the destructive potential that is fostered by certain permanent conditions and mobilized by sudden traumatic events. Without these provoking factors, the destructive energies in these populations seem to be dormant, and not, as with the destructive character, a constantly flowing source of energy. A vengeful destructiveness is a spontaneous reaction to intense and unjustified suffering inflicted upon a person or the members of the group in whom he is identified. It differs from normal defense aggression in two ways. It occurs after the damage has been done, and hence is not a defense against a threatening danger. It is of much greater intensity, and is often cruel, lustful, and insatiable. Language itself expresses the particular quality of vengeance in the term thrust, or thirst for vengeance. It hardly needs to be emphasized how widespread vengeful aggression is, both among individuals and groups. We find it in the form of the blood revenge as an institution practically all over the world. The East and Northeast Africa, the Upper Congo, West Africa, among former frontier tribes in Northeast India, Bengal, New Guinea, Polynesia, and Corsica until recently, and it was widespread among the North American Aborigines. Blood revenge is a sacred duty that falls upon the member of a family or clan or tribe who has to kill a member of the corresponding unit if one of his people has been killed. In contrast to simple punishment, where the crime is expiated by the punishment of the murderer or those to whom he belongs, in the case of blood revenge, the punishment of the aggressor does not end the sequence. The punitive killing represents a new killing, which in turn obliges the members of the punished group to punish the punisher, and so on and so on infinitum. Theoretically, blood revenge is an endless chain, and in fact is sometimes led to the extinction of families or larger groups. One even finds blood revenge, although as an exception, among very peaceful populations like the Greenlanders, who do not know the meaning of war, although, as Davy writes, the practice is but slightly developed, and the duty does not, as a rule, seem to weigh heavily on the survivors. Kind of like the Hatfield and McCoy, blood feuds all over the world. Excuse me. The baths is in the Gaza, where you're seeing this type of aggression. And again, you're seeing it in the Congo. You're seeing it in South in Africa. You're seeing it all over the world. You know, vengeance being struck, but more so, possibly more notable as in Hatfield and McCoy reference, or the, you know, the blood feuds that exist through families and mafia and royalty and you name it. Everybody seems to have a blood feud. Why is vengeance such a deep-seated, let's see. Why is vengeance such a deep-seated and intense passion? I can only offer some speculations. Let us consider first the death and vengeance in some sense a magic act. By destroying the one who committed the atrocity, his deed is magically undone. This is still expressed today by saying that the criminal has paid his debts, at least in theory. He is now like someone who never committed a crime. Vengeance may be said to be the magic reparation, but even assuming that this is so, why is this desire for reparation so intense? Perhaps man is endowed with an elementary sense of justice. This may be because there is a deep-rooted sense of existential equality. We all are born from mothers. We were once powerless children, and we shall all die. Although man can often not defend himself against the harm others inflict upon him in his wish for revenge, he tries to wipe this sheet clean by denying magically that the damage was ever done. It seems that envy has the same root. Cain could not stand the fact that he was rejected while his brother was accepted. The rejection was arbitrary, and it was not in his power to change it. This fundamental injustice aroused such envy that the score could only be evened out by killing Abel. But there must be more to the cause of vengeance. Man seems to take justice into his own hands when God or secular authorities fail. It is as if in passion for vengeance, he elevates himself to the role of God and of the angels of vengeance. The act of vengeance may be his greatest hour just because of his self-elevation, which explains the mass murderers and stuff who elevate themselves to that level of God wrongfully and unworthily. We can entertain some further speculations. Cruelties like physical mutilation, castration, and torture violate the minimal demands of conscience common to all men. In the passion for vengeance against those who commit such inhuman acts, immobilized by this elementary conscience, or could it be, in addition, a defense against the awareness of one's own destructiveness or the projected device? They, not I, are destructive and cruel. Answers to these questions require further study of the phenomenon of vengeance. The considerations offered thus far, however, seem to support the view that the passion for vengeance, confidence in life, enjoys it, whose material resources may not be ample but sufficient not to elicit stinginess, will be less eager for the reparation of paid damage than an anxious, hoarding person who is afraid that he can never make up for his losses. This much can be stated with some degree of probability. The thirst for revenge can be plotted on a line at one end in which the person in whom nothing will arouse a wish for revenge. These are men who have reached a degree of development which in Buddhist or Christian terms is the ideal for all men, which is the Christhood, the achieving Christhood. I guess basically if you've reached that level in your journey to the level to Christhood, which is what everyone wishes to become in the long haul, wishes to attain this life or the next. We are rather staggering. We're still rather staggering Neanderthals when it comes to esoteric knowledge and reasoning, using icons and understanding the iconic symbols that are gateways to our souls and to the other dimensions. And we slowly and but surely begin to awaken to the realities that we are, the reality that we are, the multi-realities that we exist in. And for instance, when we talk about multi-realities or parallel realities, let us look, for instance, at, say, we are different in the eyes of our mother than we are in the eyes of our sister or brothers or fathers or grandparents or whoever individually. We are seen differently by all of them. And we are either a threat or a burden or a joy or a pleasure. You know, whatever that is that we are to them is what they materialize to be before us. In other words, you know, who we disrespect, who we dislike, who we hate in our lives, we never get a second chance to either accept an apology or to restore to bestow one, whichever is needed most. But these are the these are basically the essential some of the essential destructive attributes to the human psyche. And whether or not they're instinctive is still an ongoing debate here, but definitely they are there. Suffering from the awareness of his powerlessness and the separateness, man can try to overcome his existential burden by achieving a trance-like state of ecstasy, to be beside oneself, and thus to regain unity within himself and with nature. Now that's ecstatic destructiveness, which is how we think it would be, but there are many ways to accomplish this. A very transitory one is provided by nature in the sexual act. This experience may be said to be the natural prototype of complete concentration and momentary ecstasis. It may include the sexual partner, but too often remains a narcissistic experience for each of the two, who perhaps share mutual gratitude for the pleasure they have given each other, conventionally felt as love. We have already referred to other symbiotic, more lasting and intense ways to arrive at ecstasy. We find these in religious cults, such as ecstatic dances, the use of drugs, frenzied sexual orgies, or self-induced states of trance. In outside examples for a self-induced state are the trance producing ceremonies in Bali. They are particularly interesting in relation to the phenomenon of aggression, because in one of the ceremonial dances, the participants use a kris, a special kind of dagger, with which they stab themselves and occasionally each other at a very height of the trance. There are other forms of ecstasis in which hate and destructiveness are the center of the experience. Some example is the going berserk to be found among the Teutonic tribes. Berserk means bear shirt. This was an initiation rite in which the male young was induced into the state of identification with a bear. The initiated would attack people trying to bite them, not speaking but simply making noises like a bear. To be in this trance-like state was the highest accomplishment of this ritual, and to have participated in it was the beginning of independent manhood. The expression Führer, Teutonicus, implies the sacred nature of this particular state of rage. Several features in this ritual are worthy of note. First of all, it is a stage for the sake of rage, not direct against an enemy or provoked by any damage or insult. It aimed at a trance-like state, which in this case is organized around the all-pervasive feeling of rage. It may be that the indication of this state was helped by drugs. The unifying source of force, rather, of absolute hate was required as a means to arrive at the experience of ecstasis. Secondly, it is a collective state based on tradition, the guidance of shamans, and the effect of group participation. Thirdly, it is an attempt to regress to animal existence, in this case that of a bear. The initiates behave like a predatory animal. Right? Ultimately, it is a transitory and not a chronic state of hate. Another example of a ritual that has survived until today and that shows the state of trance organized around rage and destructiveness can be seen in a small Spanish town. Every year on a certain date, the men get together on the main square, each with a small or large drum. At exactly midday, they begin to beat the drums and do not stop until 24 hours later. After a while, they get into a state of frenzy that becomes a state of trance in the process of this continued beating of the drums. After exactly 24 hours, the ritual ends. The skins of many of the drums have been broken. The hands of the drummers are swollen and often bleeding. The most remarkable feature of this process is the faces of the participants. They are the faces of men in a trance, and the expression they show is that of a frenzy of hate. It is obvious that the beating of the drums gives expression to powerful destructive impulses. And while the rhythm at the beginning of the ritual probably helped to stimulate the trance-like state, after a while each drummer is completely possessed by the passion to beat. And this passion takes over completely. And only because of the strength of its intensity are the drummers capable of continuing for 24 hours in spite of their hurting hands and their increasingly exhausted bodies. The worship of destructiveness. In many ways similar to ecstatic destructiveness and the chronic dedication of a person's whole life to hate and destructiveness, not a momentary state is in ecstasis. It has nevertheless the function of taking hold of the whole person, of unifying him in the worship of one goal, to destroy. This state is a permanent ideology of the god of destruction. His devotee has, as it were, given over his life to him. An excellent example of this phenomenon can be found in the autobiographical novel of E. von Sullivan. Accessories to murder in the 1922 of W. Rathnow, the liberal and gifted German foreign minister. Von Sullivan, who was born in 1902, son of a police officer who was a military cadet when the German Revolution broke out in 1918. He was filled with burning hate against the revolutionaries, but equally against the bourgeois middle class, which he felt was satisfied with the common the comforts of material existence, and had lost the spirit of sacrifice and devotion to the nation. He was at times in sympathy with the most radical wing of the left revolutionaries because they too wanted to destroy the existing order. Von Salomon made friends with a like-minded fanatical group of ex-officers, among them Kern, who later killed Rathenau. He was eventually apprehended and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Like his hero Kern, von Salomon may be considered a prototype of the Nazi, but is in contrast to most of the latter, von Salomon and his group were men without optimism or desire to even the comforts of life. Sounds like a rather solemn dude. In this autobiographical novel, von Salomon says of himself, "I had always my special pleasure in destruction. Thus I can feel in the midst of the daily plan an absorbing pleasure in seeing how the baggage of ideas and values has diminished, how the arsenal of idealism has been ground piece by piece until nothing remained but a bundle of flesh with raw nerves, nerves that like taut strings rendered each tune vibrantly and doubtful doubly so in the thin air of isolation." Von Salomon had not always been as devoted to destruction as the sentence would make it appear. It seems that some of his friends, especially Kern, who impressed him tremendously, had influenced him with their own more fanatical attitude. A very interesting discussion between von Salomon and Kern shows the latter's dedication to the absolute destructiveness and hate. Von Salomon begins the conversation by saying, "I want power. I want an aim that fills my day. I want life totally with all the sweetness of this word. I want to know what the sacrifices are worthwhile." Kern answers him fiercely, "Damn it, stop your questions. Tell me if you don't know it. A great happiness is happiness that you are greedy for, than the one we experience only by the violence by which we perish like dogs." I'd like to read this more of an unkern of a revolutionary, it appears. Pages later, Kern says, "I could not bear it if greatness could grow again out of the rubble of this time. We do not fight so that the nation is happy. We fight to force it into the line of fate. But if this man, Rathenau, gives the nation a face once more, if we can mobilize it once more to a will and to a form which died in the war, that I could not bear." In answering the question how he, as an imperial officer, survived the day of revolution, he says, "I did not survive it. I have, as honor commanded, put a bullet in my head on the 19th of November, 1918. I am dead. What lives in me is not me. I have not known an I since that day. I died on the for the nation. For everything lives in me only for the nation. And now could I bear it? And how could I bear it if it were different?" Anyway, got about 4 minutes left to the show. Not really sure. Maybe we can discuss this, which is the next segment. The phenomenon of spontaneous transitory outburst of destructiveness has so many facets that a great deal of further study is necessary. And this is the destructive character and sadism. On the other hand, the data on destructiveness in its character-bound forms are richer and more definite. This is not surprising if we consider that they are gained from prolonged observations of individuals in psychoanalysis, daily life observations. There is no conventional two concepts of the nature of sadism, sometimes used separately, sometimes in combination. It kind of goes on, but we got about 3 minutes left here, and I'm trying to see if I misplaced my notes, so therefore it's hard for me to understand. Part of this goes into Hitler's his issues, but relations to women regarding Hitler. Hitler's relation to women shows the same lack of love and tenderness or compassion as do his relations to men. This statement could seem to contradict that Hitler was very attractive, very attached to his mother. But if you assume that Hitler's incestuousness was of the malignant type, that he was tied to mother, but that this tie was cold and impersonal, he will be prepared to find that his relations to women in his latter life were also cold and impersonal. Among the women in whom Hitler was interested, he can distinguish essentially two categories, characterized mainly by their respective social positions. The respectable woman, distinguished by their social status, wealth, or by successive actresses, and the women who were successful actresses and women who were socially beneath them, like his half niece, Eva Braun. Behavior and feelings toward the first group were quite different than those toward the second group. And I'll leave it at that right now. It's pretty much out of time. I want to thank everybody for joining me. The night went kind of fast. Tomorrow night, we're off, and we'll be back on Wednesday. So I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight, and wish you the best. Good night.